at the farm, had just left the building to run an errand. I remember vividly his recollection of rushing back to the office to search for bodies and secure classified material. In October 1983, Hezbollah bombed a U.S. military facility in Lebanon, killing 241 U.S. servicemen, including 220 Marines. International terrorism was growing, and the United States needed better intelligence and a better response. In 1985, President Reagan demanded that something be done. Vice President George H.W. Bush, who had earlier served as the director of the CIA, took the lead. Vice President Bush established and chaired a commission. This blue ribbon panel soon identified weaknesses in the intelligence community's capabilities, including a gap between understanding the enemy and responding to the threat. Most of all, there was no single entity within the government responsible for countering terrorism. The commission recommended a center for the collection and analysis of intelligence and argued for more robust responses, including covert action. Acting on these findings, the CIA established CTC in February 1986. CTC would serve as the intelligence hub for the counterterrorism mission. To fill the gaps in our understanding of the threat, CTC merged operators and analysts under the same command. They would work together to identify, track, and defeat the terrorist enemy. CTC was where the CIA blended collection and analysis, and where the agency crafted and employed covert action. CTC executed these covert action operations, designed to complement U.S. foreign policy, in concert with CIA stations and often with foreign liaison partners around the world. The clandestine services geographic divisions, reacting like any bureaucracy sensing potential competition for resources, resisted this new entity. Over time, they grudgingly accepted CTC, or at least its growing expertise and money. Serving abroad at the time, I interpreted the announcement of CTC as just another HQS office with another mission. CTC had no consequential influence upon my field operations. The Iron Curtain would not crumble for another 3 years. For me, as for many other CIA officers, the Cold War conflicts trumped the Japanese Red Army or Iranian revolutionaries. Over the course of the next several years, however, terrorism as a tactic was more widely adopted by many politically disaffected groups. CTC grew to match the threat. CTC developed new methodologies of identifying and finding terrorist operatives. Using all-source collection in a constant feedback loop between collection and analysis, the timeline for responding grew shorter and shorter. CTC developed and expanded covert action. This required special surveillance teams and incident response experts such as bomb technicians, hostage negotiators, and tactical assault leaders. Because of the evolving terrorist threat combined with CTC's initial successes, this new center garnered more resources and grew in both size and stature. Under respected leaders like Winston Wiley and Jeff O'Connell, CTC recruited more and better officers, as well as law enforcement officers, attorneys, propaganda specialists, linguists, and more. CTC started training foreign liaison services so as to improve their capabilities. Counterterrorism budgets grew. With authority and increasing talent and money, CTC gained influence within the CIA and forged deeper operations with all the line geographic divisions in the clandestine service. If a COS wanted an operation funded and supported, CTC often served the purpose, assuming there was a viable terrorist target. CTC in covert action, however, only addressed part of the challenge. Intelligence and covert action should never serve as a policy substitute or an excuse for policy failure. Professor Roy Godson, in his superb book, Dirty Tricks or Trump Cards, wrote, "Covert action means influencing conditions and behavior in ways that cannot be attributed to the sponsor." He added, The essential principle of covert action is this. To be effective, it must be a part of a well-coordinated policy. He described covert action as the handmaiden of policy, and stressed that, because covert action is not a substitute for policy, it is generally counterproductive when used by a government that has not decided what it wants to do. A government that acts simply to do something while it refuses to commit resources in a sustained, coordinated manner. Nor is covert action a magic bullet to be used alone when almost everything else has failed. It must be coordinated with and supported by diplomatic, military, and/or economic measures. Governments engage in covert action to influence people and events secretly as a supplement to broader foreign policy. This was nothing new. In the 3rd century BC, King Philip II of Macedon, the father of Alexander the Great, reportedly claimed that a donkey laden with gold can pass through the mountains where no army can. Through my studies and my experience, I knew that covert action should not serve as a replacement for policy or even as a long-term placeholder. Nor should it contravene or undermine policy, but rather reinforce it. Political leaders, policymakers, and strategists should not view covert action as a solution to a foreign policy challenge, but rather as a transitory, highly specialized instrument of statecraft that only works when orchestrated with other foreign policy elements. Yet the United States, in particular, has a history of default to covert action in desperate times. In certain periods of crisis, foreign policy can be ill-formed, weak, and confused, and political leaders can place an inordinate emphasis on covert action, usually with poor results, such as the 1961 Bay of Pigs fiasco in Cuba, or the 1973 coup against President Allende in Chile. On the other hand, the CIA covert action in Central America during the 1980s thwarted Soviet and Cuban influence, but White House involvement in illegal operations ensnared CIA officers, bringing legal trouble and bad press. Intelligence and security services usually have the lead in covert action. In the United States, the CIA has this responsibility. There are several reasons for this. First, by definition, covert action is secret, and these agencies are structured for secret operations. Second, successful covert action requires specific intelligence that these agencies should collect. Third, these agencies should manage trusted foreign agents of influence to execute covert action operations. The management of these foreign agents requires tradecraft employed by intelligence services. Fourth, intelligence and security agencies should not have foreign policy agendas, although some do, because intelligence informs policy but does not make it. An intelligence service can execute covert action that conforms to policy, at least in principle. In the next decade, I would see history forgotten and hard lessons relearned. The CIA's aggressive covert action role at the forefront of a weak and fractured U.S. counterterrorism policy would bear the brunt of political and legal battles. The CIA would pay a price in a geopolitical policy environment often led by those who did not understand intelligence or who chose to manipulate it for their own preconceived agendas. President George W. Bush would order legal covert action, such as the detention of terrorist combatants and enhanced interrogation techniques, only to have President Barack Obama direct his attorney general to investigate CIA officers for possible illegal conduct. My education in this politically fraught netherworld nexus of policy and covert action was just beginning. I arrived at CTC in September 1999, as one of Kofor Black's three deputies. His principal deputy would be the late Ben Bonk, a scholar and leader, responsible for all analysis and the policy community. The other deputy was an FBI special agent who focused on law enforcement liaison. He was decent and well-intentioned, but but never contributed the way Dale Watson had a couple of years earlier. I was responsible for all the CIA's global counterterrorism operations. Kofor instructed me to get settled, review current operations, and provide initial impressions. "You have a week," he said. "Yes, sir," I answered. I would repeat that response to Kofor often in the next 3 years. I read Director Tenet's mandate for a new, more vigorous strategy against AQ. He had been pushing for greater effectiveness since the previous year, after the East Africa bombings. With Kofor and his new leadership team in CTC, Tenet expected more pressure on AQ. I ordered a variety of maps, including the South Asian subcontinent, nation-states like Sudan, specific districts in Afghanistan, and the suburbs of Beirut. I noted the CIA's clandestine service locations around the world. Then I outlined the safe havens of AQ.